welcome to take two. Thank you so much for subscribing. How do you think our first hour at take one went, Robbie?
It was all right, wasn't it?
It wasn't bad, okay. Considering we've never worked together before.
I know. The rapport was on point.
Yeah, it was. Last week, Anna recommended films for 13-year-old Noah in the classic horror genre. And this week, David Litchie has emailed in with some further recommendations for Noah, who I feel captured the imagination of the listeners. Noah, you should seek out Dark City from 1998, specifically the director's cut. Like every movie made before we were born, this can rightly count for you as a classic. Since you already like Hitch and Universal Horror, the stunning art direction and cinematography won't be lost on you. Visually, it's just one of the noirest of noirs. It's got a solid Twilight Zone-y mystery, has its little horrors, and is pretty rewarding sci-fi as well. I think most people would like it, but you already have the background to enjoy it more deeply in the way that cinephilia will prove rewarding now and then for the rest of your life. But do make sure it's the director's cut. It does a much better job of unveiling. Sunrise 1928 is both a cinematic masterpiece and so engaging that it's easy to not notice that it's a masterpiece. Watch it with the original movie tone score, the one that its director oversaw. It's often noted that the first Oscar winner for Best Picture was Wings, which deserves the accolade for doing flight scenes in 1928, which no one has done as well until this year's Top Gun Maverick, as we talked about earlier. But people often miss that there was another winner that year. Best Unique and Artistic Picture, Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, which few films have deserved as much as this one does, especially because it's artsy, but not in the slightest bit fartsy. It is not homework. It is dark and warm and wonderful. Also, Anna is 100% correct about Night of the Hunter. All the best, David Litchie. I agree about Night of the Hunter.
Great recommendations there. Sunrise as well. I wouldn't have thought of for a 13-year-old, but no, absolutely. It's an all-age masterpiece, that one. It's wonderful.
Dark City?
Oh, yeah, I love Dark City. In fact, I was trying to think, because horror is so expansive, what would I recommend to a 13-year-old? The BBC Ghost Stories at Christmas are so terrifying, and they're not unsuitable. The only thing that's, you know, difficult about them is how terrifying they are. It's a really beautiful avenue of horror and ghost story and mystery. And the Mark Gatiss ones, the yes, recent revival of that strand, have been so good. The one about the mezzotint,
yes,
that was on at Christmas,
I saw,
was
that
hair-raising.
It was
perfectly
terrifying.
Perfectly suitable for a 13-year-old, but you will not sleep afterwards.
Also, Ghostwatch, I think, is one of those
classic
horrors with Michael Parkinson as himself. I think it's the 30th anniversary of Ghostwatch. It's a good time to dig that out. Email us at correspondence@kermodemayo.com or correspondence@kermodemayo.com or whichever iteration of correspondence you would like. One frame back now. This is where we explore films that are connected in some way to one of this week's releases. Now, this week, we're recommending true crime documentaries inspired by My Old School this week. We've got some really good recommendations from people on Twitter. Andy Fish says, the best has to be OJ Made in America. It's 8 hours long, but it's gripping from start to finish. It's one of those documentaries that you think you know the story, but you really don't. English Geek 82 on Twitter. Dear Zachary has never left me since I first watched it. Truly gripping and horrifying. Tommy Butler says, for me, it will always be The Staircase. Watched it late night on BBC Two way back in 2004 and was completely enthralled. Then I found the follow-up in lockdown and became entrenched again. And no, I am still not sure about whether Peterson was 100% guilty. So many theories. Did you watch the...
Yes, I discovered it, as in fact a later correspondent says, via the Colin Firth and Toni Collette drama.
Yes, The Staircase. So Spreckbubble on Twitter has said, I'd like to nominate something I haven't even seen. I don't particularly like true crime. The Staircase, a 2004 French documentary about Michael Peterson. I found the recent HBO series brilliant, which felt like a making of said documentary, especially Toni Collette. Brilliant. So they've not seen... the documentary.
Yes, but they've seen the drama.
They've seen the drama.
It was inspired by the documentary.
And
which is the way
the
that I
thing.
Discovered it, in fact, was working backwards.
Yes.
And it's a really, really good recommendation. I also want to pick up on another recommendation we've got here from James Rodriguez, who says, The Imposter, directed by Bart Layton, is an exceptional tale that's so strange it's true. Now, for me, when I was thinking about My Old School, which is a story about an imposter, that was the film that springs to mind. Also, sorry, I should say Andy Fisher's recommendation of OJ Made in America. What a film. For me, that's one of the great long-form documentaries of recent years, if not ever. I remember watching that and thinking, not only do I now understand the OJ story, I now understand the entire United States of America.
Right.
Everything that's happening in that country now makes
sense. It's a great way in.
Sense.
Yes.
But yes, The Imposter, directed by Bart Layton, is my pick. Now, this is about a French con man called Frederick Bourdin, who pretended to be an American kid who had gone missing. He phoned up the police and turned himself in as this child who'd gone missing years earlier. He's then reunited with the family of this missing kid, who accept him as their kid, despite the fact that he's 7 years older, has different coloured hair, different coloured eyes, and is French.
It's
now,
so weird.
Why did Frederick Bourdin do that? Why did the family react in that way?
Yeah.
And this becomes it. So the film is grappling with these two mysteries at once. And it is absolutely gripping. And in a very kind of satisfying way, like in fact that Tommy alluded to about The Staircase, is that at the end of it, you are still turning things. You know, documentaries don't have to answer every question that they raise.
Mm.
You're still turning these things over in your head. You know, what is this? Do I really believe that this could have happened? Or am I getting carried away with the conspiracy? And is it more likely to be this? It's such a great film. It's absolutely one to seek out if you haven't seen it. The Imposter by Bart Layton.
I found it quite a frustrating ending. Like you say, it did leave you with so many more questions than it answered.
It's been almost, I think, a decade since I saw it. But the final shot is someone digging possibly in vain.
Yes, that's what I was left foot with. And it obviously was in vain, otherwise they would have put it in the film. I think that's what annoyed me a little bit. But then I watched Orphan First Kill recently, and it's essentially the same story. I thought that was quite weird. Like you say, I saw The Imposter about a decade ago. So seeing it again in a kind of horror light was, I don't know, it felt maybe more palatable almost than the documentary. I love the Netflix series Don't F With Cats, because I think it's such a great way of feeling like this community coming together who are all obsessed with animals or cats or whatever, but it's not really about that. It's about them tracking down a killer. And everybody sort of thinks they have it in them, I think, to be a super sleuth. And this is showing how ordinary people can actually solve crimes because they will put the time and the effort in, which perhaps the authorities don't. And I really liked Don't F With Cats. I'm not saying the full title, for obvious reasons. Time now for more Hugh Bonneville, the star of I Came By. Here is my conversation with Hugh. And we're back with Hugh Bonneville in take two. So let's get into it then, Hugh.
What's different about part two? I'm now very nervous. So you're about to start getting the dentist drill out or something.
Absolutely. So can we expect to see you doing more of these kinds of roles? Is this something that you are hoping to explore a lot more of in the future?
Oh, goodness me. I've no idea. That's up to producers, you know, see whether they want to. But it was certainly really enjoyable to play something that's not quite what you expect. Mm-hmm. And of the projects that I've got coming up over the horizon, you know, there'll be one or two, hopefully, that will surprise me, if not anybody else. They say the devil always has the best tunes, and it was certainly fun to go down this particular path. So, yeah, I'd love to.
What kind of films do you enjoy watching yourself, if you are by yourself?
Gosh, I suppose I came across L.A. Confidential, which I hadn't watched for ages.
Oh, really? It's great.
And again, like we were saying a bit earlier, I think there's such an appetite, or there is such pleasure in intelligent scripts, in interesting, complicated characters. I was watching Heat again the other day, and when you're screaming at De Niro, don't turn the car around, just, you know, go off and be happy. Oh, God, he's turned the car around. You know, where you've got really interesting three-dimensional characters that you can go on a journey with. And I just think, you know, films like those, you know, proper dramas with intelligence and wit and great cinematography and everything else and good casting, I think there's a great appetite. And I think these single films, and it's great that Netflix came in and supported this film, which was being put together by a coalition of the willing, you know, in this delicate way that independent films so often have had to struggle to get financed, and the way that they're put together is so complex. And then to have the solidity of Netflix behind it and say, right, this is we're with you, and let Babak get on with it and do it in his way. So you get a distinct authorial voice, you know, shining through and being able to create these great stories. I think that's, you know, it's great. But they are cinema experiences as much as we've all, you know, in lockdown learned to live with watching in our sitting rooms at home or even on our watches, God forbid. But
no.
but to see films with other people, yeah. I mean, you know, it's as vivid and important as going to a gig or, you know, that collective experience, I think. I remember feeling the same watching Downton with a audience for the first time. We were at a screening in Washington, D.C., showing a bit of season 6, the final season. And it was the first time it had been shown amongst a big audience of like 300 or 400 people. And suddenly you heard this collective reaction to a Maggie Smith, you know, one-liner or a poignant moment or whatever it was. And you really sense that all these people who've been watching the show in their living rooms, you know, for X number of years, were suddenly able to share it together. And that is just a simple, obvious statement of fact about cinema or theatre or yes. a gig or a ballet or a piece of music, that it is a collective human experience. Mm-hmm. And be you watching a tentpole movie or a small, dark genre film like this, I think watching it with strangers in the darkened room is very exciting.
What is your favourite memory of a cinematic experience then, apart from the Downton one?
Gosh, that's interesting. Actually, it's a strange one. The one that's just popped into my head was trying to go and see Bedknobs and Broomsticks, I think it was. When was that? Didn't that come out in like 69, 70, somewhere around, or a little bit later? I remember trying to go and see it at the Odeon Marble Arch several times. We lived in central London, and every time we went to see it, there was a bomb scare. It was the time of a lot of bomb scares in London. And so when I finally got to see it, it was a great relief, but albeit a bit tense. But also in the same cinema, actually, I do remember seeing a reprint in 70mm of Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow.
And at the Odeon in Marble Arch, and being absolutely blown away by the scale of what a big screen means.
Yes.
And that's always stayed with me as a vivid cinematic experience, and really understanding the aesthetic and visceral pleasure of watching in a cinema. Mm. And as I said, you know, obviously the pandemic changed everything, and the way that we receive films now is very different. And we all, you know, completely absorbed in the world of box sets and long-running dramas. And, you know, 15 years ago, those sorts of long-running dramas just weren't happening in the same way. And now that's a sort of standard format, you know, a 10-part series
yeah.
On a streamer or indeed on a terrestrial channel. But the single film, I think, you know, there is a potential danger of losing it because they are perhaps not as cost-effective, you know, as a series might be. Once you've built the sets and everything, you might as well just keep churning out,
yeah.
you know, episodes. But there's the single drama, that's that unique story that is told in a cinematic way, I think is incredibly valuable, and we tinker with it at our peril. And so to have, you know, whichever producer's doing it, be it Netflix or any other, or a studio, to give the filmmaker that autonomy to tell those stories that are not just going to be churned out and repeated and are not formulaic, is absolutely vital to the future of our industry. And of course, you know, being surprised by news stories, even though they, you know, they're based on the same 37 stories that there may be in the world,
yes.
is always exciting.
I'm so glad you mentioned Bedknobs and Broomsticks, by the way, because I'm getting married on Saturday, and that is one of our tables.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
how brilliant.
Out of all of the, you know, we're having like every table is yeah. a different film, and Bedknobs and Broomsticks is one
how
of ours.
How fantastic.
Ours.
How come? Because it was a childhood favourite.
Yeah, and both of ours, and we both quote it all the time. And another thing, actually, that we quote all the time is one of your lines from Notting Hill when you're talking to Julia Roberts. And are you always surprised by what audiences kind of remember about your movies, or what they... what captures the imagination?
Can I ask what other tables are called at your wedding?
We've got Rear Window, uh-huh. we've got The Shining, uh-huh. We're on Singing in the Rain.
Brilliant.
And then we've got Pride and Prejudice and Twin Peaks as our two television series.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Oh, how wonderful. That's yeah. a great idea. I suppose with something like Notting Hill, it's interesting that so many people talk about the sort of the dinner party sequence where Hugh brings Julia Roberts' character, Anna Scott, to dinner. And it's interesting that sort of, in relation to I suppose, my character, but to the nub of the story, that's where the story started, because Richard Curtis, in real life, has a group of friends from university days, and they used to meet up, well, I don't know whether they still do, but they certainly did back in the day, meet up regularly for dinner at their friend's house, who was a terrible, terrible cook, but he always, you know, gave it his best. Piers always gave it his best shot. But it wasn't about that. It was about their friendship and their connection and their shared history. And he thought, what if I took as my date the most famous, you know, film star in the world? How would each of my chums react? And so that's really the nub of the story. And then the story sort of grew outwards from there. So I think because there's a real authenticity to that experience, and we can all project on that, you know, what if, how would Kevin or Sharon or Jane or John react if I brought round whoever it might be? And the truth of that, the simple truth of that story was resonates. And that's what often people mention. And it's lovely. And there's a whole... What makes me feel very old, though, of course, is that, you know, my daughter's just watched, or my son's just watched Notting Hill for the first time, and they really enjoyed it. So it's on the one hand, it's nice that they...
Thank God they enjoyed it.
Well, exactly. It's nice that there's a new generation enjoying it. On the other hand, I'm virtually a great-grandfather.
What about the reaction from kids who see you now and compared to adults? Because presumably their reaction must be very different.
Yes, I suppose because of the bear with the marmalade habit.
As we mentioned earlier.
That's delightful. And what's been really gratifying, and I don't know why David Walliams has suddenly popped into my head, but knowing that that so many of his, in a nice way, I mean, the film, the TV versions of so many of his books have prompted kids into reading.
Yes.
And in the same way, where, you know, that Roald Dahl was absolutely passionate about his stories, you know, if they were incarnated in a film or TV version, so long as it led to more children reading, and that's what his passion was, you know, getting kids to read. And the number of young people who've enjoyed the Paddington, and grown-ups who've enjoyed the Paddington films, but have been prompted, therefore, to pick up the books and just to read more widely in general. Mm. So that's a great thing. But
and, of course, you've played Roald Dahl yourself as well.
Yes, I did a couple of years ago, which was a great insight into the world of the writer in this case going through incredible trauma when they lost a child to measles. But it took me back to the books, which I hadn't read for, you know, since I was a kid, and I hadn't read that many of them. So to revisit that children's literature was really fun, and I've loved being part of the Paddington world, because I just think the Paddington stories are just immaculate little
so well written
glimmers of a sort of three-act structure in each little story, you know, always trying to resolve on the positive, and as do the movies.
We have some listener questions for you, and this one seems quite appropriate, from Jonathan Root, who's asked, what was Paddington's reaction to I Came By?
I can remember when Paddington was first when we just finished the first one and the sort of marketing pictures came out. There was a shot of Paddington Bear in his blue overcoat and the red hat, but he was literally inanimate. It wasn't, you know, it was a picture, and so people started putting him in posters of movies like he was a sort of serial killer.
I've been following this Twitter page.
Yeah, it's very smart, very funny. And it was slightly disruptive because people, you know, Paddington purists were saying, how dare they do this? Paddington's going to be ruined. It's going to be awful. And so it was rather lovely that when the film came out, people went, oh, actually, it's rather good. but that sort of slightly disturbing. There was a wonderful one, I think, of him in Psycho.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah, just standing by a shower
behind
curtain.
With, you know, the shadow.
Just all you just see is the shape standing there against the curtain. Brilliant. So Paddington is well versed in all forms of different types of films. And so he loved this.
Final question, listener question from Jane B, who says, you mainly play nice people, though you've been sinister in a few roles. Never forgiven you for what you did to Joan Plowright in Knife Edge.
Oh yeah.
She prefers you being nice. What's your favourite type of role to play?
That's a really hard one to answer. I really enjoyed playing Hector Blake in this. But I do have to say, I love a bit of comedy.
Yes. Thank you so much, Hugh Bonneville, for joining us. That was the lovely Hugh Bonneville. Thank you to him. I didn't realise I laughed quite so loudly for quite a lot of that.
He's an entertaining chap.
He is very funny. And he does very funny facial expressions.
I love the stuff about the creepy Paddington meme, because I remember the studio was terrified when that happened. They were absolutely frantic that they had produced this thing that was like a monstrosity. And of course, it was nothing like it, because people hadn't seen
it. It wasn't Sonic, was it?
The character movie. Thank goodness it wasn't Sonic. It's the opposite. It's the anti-Sonic. Sonic is the anti-Paddington. But no, I remember the absolute kind of vibrations of terror that were going through the UK film industry at the time that Paddington was going to be some complete disaster. And of course, it was the absolute opposite of that. It was so wonderful. And still, I mean, he says he loves comedy. The part where he disguises himself as the cleaning lady in that first film, it's the facial expression,
it's
as you said.
So good.
And it's just, it's not overplayed either, but there's just a beautiful kind of total loss of dignity in that shot of him emerging as the cleaning lady. It's just so funny.
And it's, I guess what's funny is because I still listen to the stories. You know, I have Stephen Fry narrating it. And actually for one of, I can't remember, I think for a Christmas present, my husband at this point when this comes out, but my partner Mike recorded some Paddington Bears for me because it's just one of my favourite things ever. And the whole idea of Mr. Brown, who is so, as you say, dignified, and he's very sardonic. He's quite similar to William Brown's father in Just William, actually.
Yes, you're right.
Very much cut from the same cloth, I think. And so just, as you say, to see him dressed up in this really ridiculous outfit is so much fun. Hugh Bonneville has just a great deal of charisma, I think, in that character, which could otherwise be quite staid. Mm-hmm. I think he does so bring so much to it. Lovely Hugh Bonneville there. Thank you so much for all your true crime documentary suggestions, and thank you so much for subscribing. Next week is a bit of a special one, as Mark and Simon are still away, so the top production team will be putting together a Take Two highlight show so that everyone can hear the Take Two magic of Mark and Simon. But for The Vanguard, Anna Bogutskaya will be interviewing Zoe Ashton for Mr. Malcolm's List. I love Anna's interviews. Her enthusiasm and her passion always comes through, so I'm very excited for this one. Thank you so much again to Robbie Collin. And what's that I can hear? Is that the sound of a ship's horn? What is that?
Avast behind!
That's a joke you don't hear anymore, isn't it?
No. Not 1971 anymore. It says I'm sipping a cool drink, which I actually am, because it's cold water taken from my Kermit and Mayo's Take branded flask.
Very good.
Which I got the captain to fill up for me earlier. I've reached the stage on the cruise where I feel fully relaxed, I think, and the panic about all the stuff I'm going to come back to on dry land hasn't set in. How about you?
Well, I love a cruise. I mean, you know, it's like getting away from everything, but still taking everything with you.
Yes. Surrounded by listeners. We're fine.
So, I mean, we brought them with.
Yeah.
How are you finding them? I mean, it's one thing when they're on the other end of a radio or an iPod or a television, but how are you finding actually interacting with them?
Well, I had good kind of learning experience because the good lady Stramacis Terindors in a previous life was the producer of the light program's Good Morning Sunday, and they actually had a Good Morning Sunday cruise in which they...
This is a real thing?
It's a real thing. They had a real ship with real listeners and the Reverend Roger Royal, and they visited holy places and they made radio programs. So that's on a ship with listeners.
But it was just Good Morning Sunday.
For 6 months.
What did they do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday?
They threw
portions of the wind.
Casinos. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Right.
Anyway, so, you know, you smile and you...
Smile and wave.
Have a good time. I'm not sure about last evening's cabaret, though.
No, I know.
I mean, I do love a bit of Best of the Musical show. My highlight was Charlie Kaufman's rendition of One Night in Bangkok from Chess. Who knew he could pull off a cat suit? I don't think we want him back on the show, though.
Anyway, it was great.
Yeah. Anyway, we've taken some time away from Zumba with Helen Mirren to do a little extra take for you. Before we left Britain's shores on this cruise, full of lovely listeners, we asked everyone for their best film of the year so far, which we did last week, and you picked...
Elvis.
So this week, as you might expect, we're doing the worst movies of the year. And let me see what we've come up with here. Anto Frey.
Yes.
The worst it brings me no pleasure to say is Moonfall. Normally, a brainless, over-the-top Roland Emmerich disaster film wouldn't get such short shrift from me, especially one with surprisingly good CGI. This one, however, makes the deliberate choice to fawn over a certain South African tech billionaire multiple times and pointedly aggrandizes conspiracy theorists worldwide. No thanks, says Anto. Chris K says Everything Everywhere All at Once didn't connect
what?
On any level.
In one of the worst of the year?
Yes. John in Okinawa. I haven't seen any really bad films because I managed to avoid a lot of them by listening to your podcast reviews. But my worst would probably be Spiderhead, which is okay. A good point. Actually, that's pretty...
Did you watch Spiderhead? You only watched half of it.
Half of it, and I thought
it was gave up.
Well, I just thought, I don't care what happens. So, you know. Matt Taylor says it's Morbius. Everything blockbuster should absolutely avoid being. Ian says Uncharted. The game character of Sully was a better actor than Wahlberg. Rory says...
Unwatched, as it was.
Scream 5, Black Phone, Cyrano and Morbius. Someone who calls herself a good tall girl, a good sturdy girl...
Yes.
Which sounds like a family quote. Worst film of the year is The Northman. Not actually terrible, but a real letdown.
Yeah. Incidentally, Cyrano. He said Cyrano, but of course, as they say in the film, Cyrano.
But they're wrong. It's Cyrano.
What are you going to do?
Okay. And Nobby Nomad says The Nan Movie, following in the grand British tradition of abysmally unfunny TV-to-movie spin-offs. So what do we have for the worst films of the year so far?
So my bottom five, at five... Moonfall, the stupidest film I have ever seen. I have to say,
I've seen lots of stupid films.
I mean, of the top five, it's at number five, meaning of all of the ones that I'm talking about, it's actually the one that I enjoyed because it was so terrible. And you're absolutely right about aggrandizing conspiracy theorists. It's the guy with the irritable bowel syndrome being taken into space in the middle of all this stuff. Lordy, lordy, Miss Claudie, it is poor and then some. At number four, and this is on the basis of what you'd expect from a film and what you get from a film, Lightyear. I'm sorry, you can write me as many emails as you want telling me why this shouldn't be considered as a Toy Story movie. It's in the Toy Story extended universe, and it is an absolute crushing disappointment. And it's in the list because it's a Toy Story adjacent film or a Toy Story film, and therefore has no right to be as singularly bad as it is. At number three, a film which I reckon that most people will simply have forgotten about, Marry Me. Do you remember Marry Me? Well,
I don't think so. Who's okay. in it?
It was a film in which Jennifer Lopez is a rock star who is going to marry another famous person who then jilts her, is unfaithful. And so she's on stage and she just looks out into the crowd and says, all right, I'm going to marry you. And then she points to dorky boy Owen Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
And then he has to marry her. And you go, what? Sorry, what? And then the rest of the film proceeds as if I'm to assume that this is okay, that she just went, I'm going to marry him, the dorky boy teacher boy. Anyway, it's absolute pants. It's just terrible, 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 terrible. And really, really badly acted and really badly written and really bad, just awful.
Okay, that's good.
Now, number two and number one, this was a kind of tightly held contest. At number two, Thor, Love and Thunder. Again, because of the what you should rightly expect from this kind of from a movie with this many resources behind it. We've already spoken in a previous show. We had a correspondence from somebody who said it's all very well blaming the VFX people for the lousy effects, but that's because they are treated really appallingly by Marvel. And absolutely, the VFX artists, more power to them. The Marvel bosses, get your finger out and start making good... Oh, actually, no, just stop. I thought Thor Love and Thunder was crushingly disappointing, and again, it's so high up because of what I expected from it. But at number one in the worst movies released so far this year, by quite some distance, it's Morbius. And the joy of Morbius is this. Morbius was released, did really, really badly, became the subject of umpteen internet memes about how terrible Morbius was. And so the distributors went, oh, look, everyone's talking about it online. Everyone's talking about it online. It's a sleeper hit. Let's re-release it. So they re-released it, and it tanked a second time. So it's the film that's so bad, they killed it twice. And incidentally, Jared Leto, who I think in the last year has probably done more to undermine his career than almost anybody else, I was watching American Psycho the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sorry, the scene involving Christian Bale, Jared Leto, Huey Lewis in the news, and an axe is the best thing Jared Leto has ever done.
It is good, isn't it?
It is just
so Morbius number one, Thor two, Marry Me three, Lightyear four, and Moonfall at five.
Yes.
Of which the one, if you had to watch another one again, definitely be Moonfall, because it
absolutely
was actually terrible.
I'd
really enjoy it. We're going to do a rest of the year preview on next week's Cruise Dispatches. Things to look out for in, it says here, the last months of 2022. Yeah. I mean,
The second half.
I mean, we're halfway through. So in the second half of the year. For now, chin chin, Mark and I are off to play Jenga with Jim Genders. Or Venga with Vim Vendors. Or Jenga with Vim Vendors. Something like that. Blow the horn!